We're not going to get to the point where he's trusting his allies and his friends. That will be this afternoon. Nor his wisdom. That will be some number of weeks from now. Or even in his own mighty men. That will be even after that. But this morning, we do want to look at another false confidence, another false hope that we find in Obadiah. And that is in Obadiah. We'll begin reading, if you will, at chapter 3. Well, why is he in the Old Testament in the morning? Aren't we supposed to read the Old Testament in the afternoon or preach from the Old Testament in the afternoon? Yes, normally that's true, but in order to keep parity with last week, we had Romans chapter 10 spill over into the afternoon service. You remember that? Those of you who were here last week, you remember that. So this morning, we'll begin with where we left off in Obadiah and pick up with Obadiah. Verse 3, the pride of thine heart hath deceived thee, thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, who shall bring me down to the ground? Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle, and though thou set thy nest among the stars, thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord. If thieves came to thee, if robbers by night, how art thou cut off? Would they not have stolen till they had enough? If the grape gatherers came to thee, would they not leave some grapes? How are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought up? May the Lord add his blessing to this reading of his word. Now, previously, we noted that the section of Obadiah starting at verse 3 and continuing through verse 9 is intended by the prophet Obadiah to manifest God's wrath and vengeance against that in which Edom placed their trust. And 2 weeks ago, we looked at that first defense, that first false hope, that first false confidence, and that was just sheer defiance. You say, well, why would he think that's enough? Well, you tell me. Do we not live in a country in which defiance is regarded as a virtue? Do we not live in a nation in which independence and standing on my own two feet separate from anybody else, is that not regarded as being highly pleasing to God? Well, God did not like it in Edom, and God doesn't like it in us either. It is pride. It is that vice that I mentioned a while ago called bravado. It is defiance. It is wicked. Say, well, when do I do that? When you speed. That's just scoff law. I'm above the law. The law, sure, it's an important law for other people. I'm glad they obey it. It makes the highway safe for people like me who speed. Now, that may seem to you like a small example. But what I am getting at is this. We are a people who, as a whole, regard ourselves as above any law with which we disagree. As long as I don't see the point of it, as long as I don't see the purpose of it, I'm free to disobey it. Now, that's a defiant attitude, and it's an attitude that God hates. If there is a wicked law, a law that is contrary to God's law, a law that keeps us from obeying God, then by all means, we have to disobey that. But even there, we should disagree with those laws and disobey those laws with the same humility with which the apostle said, you judge for yourself whether we should obey God or obey men, but as for us, we can do nothing else but obey God. Now, there is not a note of defiance in that answer. And I put it to you that even when we're called upon to defy the laws of men in order to keep the laws of God, we should do it with such a degree of humility that the magistrate himself knows he's the offender and that we are the victim of his unjust laws. So verses 3 through 9 are intended to show God's wrath, God's vengeance, falling upon those who place their trust in things other than God. And that false bravado, or true bravado, but false bravery, is one of those things. We must place our hope, listen carefully, we must place our hope on nothing short of the mercy of God. We are a people who live by mercy, and we need to acknowledge that fact. We must acknowledge that apart from God's mercy, we haven't a leg to stand on. As a nation, we are much like ancient Edom, much like those Edomians of old, who have built up confidence upon confidence upon confidence. And this morning we're going to talk about a second false confidence, and that is that he hoped in his situation. I'm sitting here in the mountains. You can't get to me. How can God possibly reach me? Look how high I am. Now, for those of you who have seen pictures, or perhaps you've seen videos, you may be familiar with a town out in the middle of the Jordanian desert called Petra, P-E-T-R-A. Now, that is the town that God is speaking about here in Obadiah. The only way in, if you're on the back of an animal, it can be basically no wider than a donkey, much smaller than a horse, maybe as large as a horse, but one person at a time can come down a long wash, a place that's been washed out by the rivers, by the waters. Those times when it does rain has washed away so that there is a narrow canyon. One person on the back of a donkey can make it down there. And, of course, imagine having to defend a place like that. You kill the first one and the rest of them are blocked. What a situation. We have made our nest among the eagles. No one can get in here. Now, if you were to go in there, say in peaceable manner, and were to search about within the town of Petra, the overwhelming structure would be one that's been carved into the side of the mountain. And in the side of the mountain, large columns have been carved. A facade has been made. So when you go into the cave, it's like walking into a large building. But in reality, you're walking into the side of the mountain. That is where they kept their treasure. This is the hidden place that Obadiah speaks of here. In verse 6, how are the things of Esau searched out? How are his hidden things sought out? And that's where he kept his treasure. In fact, till this day, that structure is called the treasure house of Petra. Now, if you go in there today, what do you suppose you'll find? Not a thing. The air you're breathing, and that's all. Because God did precisely what he said he was going to do. He searched out their hidden things. He searched out the things that they thought were going to keep them safe from attack, safe from destruction, and he destroyed them as he destroyed the people of Edom. So then, self-opinion, self-reliance, self-exaltation, self-defense, self-esteem underlay this pride of life, underlay all of the other false hopes that we shall talk about, because Edom believed this would be enough. What my hands have gotten, what my hands have gathered will be enough. So let's look at this doctrine. It is vain to trust the strength of our present situation on the earth. Now, we're going to have two shoes to drop. Right? You get ready to do something. You put on two shoes. You come home. You take off two shoes. We're going to look at both parts of this morning. And the reason I will is because when you look at this subject among many modern commentators, they say, well, since we're not to trust in the riches of this world, that must mean we're not supposed to have the riches of this world. Now, I'm here this morning to tell you exactly the opposite. In the Tower of Babel, the problem was not simply that men were building a tower. It was the motives of their hearts to build a tower to heaven. In fact, some of the old rabbis maintained that the reason they were building that tower with pitch or with slime, as it is in the Authorized Version, The reason they were building it with slime was so that the water of any future flood could not get in and keep them from building a tower higher still. Or consider Jerusalem of the Jebusites. As the Jebusites were in there in 2 Samuel chapter 5, as the Jebusites were in there calling down to the men of David, why, we could defend this place with blind and lame people. There's too much power here, too much position. We're looking down on you in a way that you can't possibly take this high ground. Or consider Babylon under Belshazzar. Remember the night that Belshazzar said, get out the good dishes. Remember the ones that belong to God? Get those out and I will drink from them. Even though he knew that the Medes and the Persians were right outside the gate, he thought to himself, my situation is such. My position is such. My place is such in the world that they can't touch me. Do you know the story behind that, children? Do you know what they did? The Medes and the Persians, in order to stave off any kind of a siege against the city, they had built a conduit for the river to come actually through the city. Now, while Belshazzar and his partners were partying and drinking to where they were passed out, the Medes and the Persians were working. And they bottled up the river. They caused it to go around the city of Babylon in such a way that they were now able to walk under the walls of Babylon and took it, we would say today, without firing a shot. Much like the men of Dan took Laish, because the people of Laish said, our position is such that we just don't need to concern ourselves with defense. Or Tyre. In Ezekiel chapter 28, the king of Tyre, look at me. Why, I shine when I walk. The sun glints off of the metal of my... How can anyone be more... Now, some people will say, well, look at Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28, and that's talking about the devil. Well, by way of application, we don't want to say that it has no application to him, but what's being spoken of there is the pride that's in the heart of men, thinking that their situation is such that they can't be brought down. And God's telling Edom through the prophet Obadiah that simply is not true. Or consider even the disciples of Jesus. As they were walking out to the Mount of Olives, they said, look at these buildings. How magnificent are they? Look how the sun shines off of the buildings, white as alabaster. And what did Jesus say to them? There's not going to be one stone left standing on another. It's all going to be brought down. And by the way, those who maintain that wall where the Jews daven over there in Jerusalem is a wall from the temple, oh no, it's not. I have Matthew 24 to assure me of that. But also historically, we know that wall was never part of the temple complex. It was part of the fortress Antonia. It was part of the fortress Antonia. It was part of that wall upon which Paul stood in Acts chapter 24 and spoke to the people of Jerusalem. It was never part of the temple complex. When Jesus said there won't be one stone left standing on another, guess what? There's not. So, consider one last example, and I'll be finished with giving you examples. Rather than giving you reason upon reason, I'm giving you example after example. Consider Jonathan and the Philistines. We talked about this a few weeks ago, didn't we? How the Philistines were so confident in their position, they said, yeah, come on up, Jonathan. What do you think you can do? You come on up here. And Jonathan had already spoken to his armor bearer. He said, if they say come up, we're going to go up because that's going to be a sign that they're going to flee before us. Now, there was only one sword in the whole land of Israel. And who do you suppose had it? Jonathan. And Jonathan climbed up between rocks. I mean, he was hand over fist to climb up to the top of this precipice. And when he got there, they were all fleeing before him. In fact, he killed 20 of them just the first acre. Then he just kept on going after that. They were fleeing before him. Now, I'm not sure how many were in a Philistine garrison. More than 20, as it turns out. The rest of them ran away. That does put me to mind of the promise that God makes in Deuteronomy that one shall chase 1,000 and two shall chase 10,000. You think one shall chase 1,000, two shall chase 2,000. It doesn't work like that. That's the power of unity. One chases 1,000, two chase 10,000. An order of magnitude greater. Well, the Lord takes upon himself to bring down high looks. As soon as we think that we have so much in this world that nobody can touch us, guess what happens? Something or somebody touches us. Not because God doesn't want us to have things, it's because God doesn't want us to place our trust in the creature, in the creation. God would have us trust him. So he delights in using weak means. And we could just spend the whole rest of the morning now on the book of Judges, couldn't we? Shamgar, right? Who had an ox goad and freed an entire nation with an ox goad. Why? Because God delights in using weak means. That doesn't mean that we should be weak, but it means that when God chooses to use an ox goad, you can count on it. 600 are going to die. Samson used the jawbone of an ass and killed. They were laying in stacks. He had to walk over the bodies to kill 1,000 with the jawbone of an ass. And so also, God says, not only to the Edomites of that day, but to all those who would trust in means in this present day, I will bring thee down. I will cause you to come down. I will cause you to fall by the very means that you trust. Jesus said in Isaiah 63:1, I have trod the winepress alone. Now, the reason I bring that up is because he's talking there about the Edomians. Who is this who comes from Edom? Who is this who's coming out of Bozrah with the blood of his enemies spattered all over his garments? Well, it's Jesus. And he says, I have trod the winepress alone. It is the Lord who overcomes his enemies. That's why I say Jehoshaphat knew how to form an army. He put the psalm singers out front. Because the psalm singers know how to fight. The psalm singers are not going to be out there saying, I can't tell the difference between good and evil. How do I know that my enemy doesn't have the right point of view? Maybe his way of thinking is the right way of thinking. Psalm singers don't think like that. Psalm singers are not interested in how much dew is on their roses. Psalm singers have rods in their backbones because they understand that God is fierce toward his enemies. It's hard for me to preach for 45 minutes or an hour without mentioning the Psalms. They are good for armies to sing. Let's make a couple of uses. Now, this sounds like we're getting into the uses very early, and so we are. But I have a couple of important uses that I want you to consider with me. The first is, let none trust in the strength or position or situation of his own dwelling. I didn't say don't have a nice house. I said don't trust in it. Be as Job, who was able to say, the Lord has given, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. I trusted God when I had a lot. And now that I have nothing but this wife, I will trust God as well. I think the reason that Satan didn't take away the wife in Job's case was because she was his ally, that is, she was Satan's ally rather than Job's. But let us not trust in our strength, our position, our situation. And I'm not speaking here simply of the army, although I think there is an excellent application for that in a day when we have almost 160,000 troops in Babylon. I think there is an application here for our armies that we not trust in our A1 Abrams, that we not trust in our ability to fight, but rather that we trust in God Our currency is among the strongest in the world. That's faint praise. To say that our currency is the strongest in the world is faint praise, because there is no strong currency in the world today, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But even our currency, which is the strongest that there is, has emblazoned upon it, "In God we trust." We don't trust the money. We don't count upon the money. We don't confide in the money. We use that money for God's glory and for our good, for our happiness, for our enjoyment, but only under the Lord. In God is our trust. So lest we imagine that we can trust our wealth, every bill you carry in your pocket contains the warning: don't trust it. Don't trust me. Trust God. We must never trust the treasures of ungodliness. God wants us to get wealth. We're going to talk about that in just a moment. God wants us to get wealth. In fact, I may even go so far as to say create wealth. But not by ungodliness. We may not do anything that is against God's law in order to enrich ourselves. Period. That's full stop. There's no but or except or maybe or might be. That's full stop. We may not do anything that's against God's law in order to enrich ourselves. Now, the ungodly may be enriched for a season, but here's what God says: I'm storing it up with them to give to you later. So God searches out the treasures of ungodliness just as he did with Edom. Where we have the word hidden things, you can understand, if you want to, hidden treasures. They had treasures hidden up in that storehouse, in that treasure house that was up in the mountains that you could only get to by winding your way down a canyon, one person at a time. And they thought they were safe. They thought their treasures would keep them. They thought their situation, their position was enough to keep God from wiping it out. But beloved, I don't care where you keep your money. If you keep it in First National Bank, or if you keep it in your wallet, or if you keep it in your mattress, God can blow on it and it's gone. That's what happened to Edom. And I've known people that it's happened to in this life as well. God will search our hearts more carefully than Laban searched Rachel's tent. There was one secret place that Laban wouldn't look. Those of you who don't know the story, you can look it up later. But there was a secret place that Rachel was sitting on that he would not look. But there is no such secret place with God. God will search out our very hearts. God will look at the intentions of our soul. God will look at our motives. God will search out everything for those hidden treasures. And he will look more carefully than a thief looks for bounty. That's what he says in this passage. He says, you know, a thief will come and hit your house, and he's only going to take as much as he can carry. If you brought a big enough truck, he might get your stuff, but he's not going to hitch it up to the back of his truck and pull your house away. He's only going to take as much stuff as he can carry. But here's what God says: I'm going to destroy it all. Nothing will be left when I get done. The grape gatherers, they might come, but they'll leave a little bit in the corners. They won't cut every last grape off. You'll still be able to go through and find at least enough for a taste. But I'm going to take everything, God says to the Edomians. Let us understand then that there is nothing in our lives that is hidden from the sight of God. You know what? You can fool me. It's kind of easy, because I want to think the best of you. So it's easy to fool me. But let me tell you who you can't fool. You can't fool God. You can pretend to be one person for mom and dad, but God knows your heart. God knows whether you're that person or not. And God will not settle for seconds. God requires to be foremost in your heart. First of all, in your thinking. And he doesn't accept any other position. God will not come into your life. God will not be part of your life as second fiddle or second chair. God will only come into our lives as concert master. Other than that, He will not do a thing on our behalf. He will regard us, in fact, as his enemies. So don't think that pleasing pastor or pleasing mom and dad is going to be sufficient for you. It won't. God promises that he will search out the hidden things. Neither, this is the second application, this is the second shoe. Just as we should not trust in riches, neither should we be content thinking God wants us to be poor. Now listen carefully. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 31, Paul talks about us using this present world without abusing it. Now understand, using this present world means that God has given us all things richly to enjoy. That is to say, all things lawful, all things legal, and I'm going to say it one time, but I want you to understand that everything that I'm saying now depends on that. It must be lawful. You must obtain it by lawful means. That's why Paul says, as using the world, but not abusing it. How do you abuse the world? By treating it in any way other than the way God has said to treat it. We must use this world without abusing it. So, a word of balance is in order. Again, why are you doing this, Pastor Bacon? Because I read so many commentaries that are written in the last 50 years. I read and hear so many sermons that have been preached since the media has made that possible, in which, on the one hand, wealth is treated almost as though you get it by a magic incantation, or on the other hand, it's altogether wicked and you shouldn't be having it anyway. So let me lay some foundational work here. First of all, we do not believe the word of faith doctrine. We reject the word of faith doctrine. We maintain that such turns prayer into magic spells and Jesus into a genie. There is no magical way to get wealth. God gave you two ways to get wealth, and there's one at the end of each arm. I'm fond of saying to people who say to me, well, opportunity only knocks once. The fact of it is, opportunity is knocking constantly, but it's wearing work clothes. We don't recognize opportunities when we see it because it's disguised as service to others. If we saw what we were supposed to see, we would see opportunity standing, begging at our door. Secondly, we do not believe that wealth in itself is wicked. In fact, I believe, can I prove this? No, but I think all the evidence is on my side. I believe that at the time Abraham was alive, he was the wealthiest man on the face of the earth. Now, why? Because he walked with God. Because he did what God said to do. Because he tithed to Melchizedek. Here's the pattern. You work six, you rest one, and you tithe on the increase. Now, everything about economics is an application of that. Work six, rest one, tithe on the increase. Everything else is application. You know, there is nothing that makes a block of gold worth less than a block of granite. There's nothing wicked about a block of gold. In fact, in Genesis 1:31, God pronounced his whole creation to be not just good, but very good. Exceedingly good. Tov ma'od. That's right. Very good. And in Genesis 2:11 and 12, he specifically points out gold as being good. Now, the reason I mention gold twice is because, and I'll say this one time and move on, gold is money. Now, I have very carefully not referred to the things that we pass around, those pictures of presidents, as money. That's currency. Gold is money. Although you can use silver as long as you keep your silver tied to gold. But the rest of it is currency. It's fiat money. Do you know what fiat money? It's money because the government says so. There was a caliph that, this story is that old. There was a caliph that used to send a bag of gold with his messenger to buy a camel once a year. And he would bring a bag of gold with him and lay it down at the camel merchant's door, and the camel merchant would give him a camel, and he'd take the camel back to the caliph. One day the caliph thought to himself, you know, this is an awful lot of trouble. I need to keep that gold in my warehouse. What I'll do is I'll give a receipt to the messenger, and he can take it to the camel dealer in place of the bag of gold. And so he wrote a message on there that says, this is a bag of gold. And the messenger came to the camel dealer and gave it to the camel dealer, came back the next day with a message that said, this is a camel. Something is not money just because the government says it is. Gold, and you can jot this down. Do the study yourself. Gold is money. In fact, in Scripture, money has weight. Paper weighs the same whether you write a 1 on it or a 5 on it or a 100 on it. But money weighs differently at 1, at 5, and at 100. Okay, I said it 3 times. I said I was going to tell you once. I told you 3 times now. Gold is money. And in Genesis 2, 11, and 12, the gold of the land was good. It was fine. It was pure. It had been purified, even coming from the hand of God. So third, what are the first two? The first principle is we're not word of faith. We don't believe that we get wealthy by praying or even by throwing a $50 bill in the collection plate. All right, don't send any money to the guys on TV. Don't give money to me thinking that that's going to make you rich. You've got two things that will make you rich. Right? One at the end of each hand or one at the end of each arm. The second thing is that we do not believe that wealth is intrinsically wicked. We believe that wealth, gold, just like granite, can be used to build the kingdom of God or it can be used to build the kingdom of Satan. It is not in itself wicked. It is not in itself good, except insofar as God says to trade with it. Now, here's the third principle. This brings the first two together. Man was created to have dominion over the creation, including its gold. Man was created for the purpose of taking dominion over the creation, including the creation's gold. But when we set our heart on the gold apart from God's commands, here's what has happened. It has taken dominion of us. Do you see the difference? The difference is whether I'm in charge or whether the gold's in charge. And if the gold so occupies my thinking, so occupies my heart, that I'll do anything to get it, then it has dominion over me. So with those three principles, I've got some therefores for you. Therefore, it makes no sense to think that trusting our situation is a more formidable temptation for the rich than it is for the poor. Can the poor not covet? Does it take a rich man to be covetous? I put it to you that while there are certain temptations that may not attract themselves to the poor, such as flattery, you know, people very seldom flatter those who aren't in positions to help them. Nevertheless, their position as far as trusting wealth is no less than a person who has great wealth. A person who has a little bit is likely to think, if I had a little bit more, I would have all I need. But a rich man, on the other hand, is more likely to think, if I had just a little bit more, I would have everything I need. So how much is enough for a greedy man? A little more. And I put it to you that that is placing trust, even though it may not be something you have, it is placing trust in stuff. That's why Paul says covetousness is idolatry. He doesn't say it's like idolatry, does he? He says it is idolatry. And the reason it is idolatry is because it teaches you to trust the creation rather than the Creator. I want you to note something with me. There are 10 commandments. 3 of those 10 commandments deal specifically with your wealth. Now, all of them have impacts. All of them impact, have applications and functions having to do with your wealth. For example, even the 7th commandment, you're not allowed to prostitute yourself for money. Right? That's the 7th commandment. It has an application having to do with money, but 3 of them deal directly with money, how to get it, and how to treat it. Right? The 4th commandment. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work. 8th commandment. Thou shalt not steal. 10th commandment. Thou shalt not covet anything that is thy neighbor's. Those all 3 have to do directly with your wealth and the wealth of your neighbor. And 2 of those 3 assume that you have a bunch of it. And your neighbor does too. How many of you have a servant? Well, then you're not as wealthy yet as the 4th commandment assumes you are. Because the 4th commandment says that you're supposed to give your manservant and your maidservant the day off, as well as yourself and your family. So if you don't have a manservant or a maidservant yet, it's because you're not as wealthy as the 4th commandment expects you to be. How about the 10th commandment? The 10th commandment expects the guy next door to be just as wealthy as you are. He's also going to have a wife and an ass and an ox and a manservant and a maidservant. Don't you expect to get his. Don't even think about his. You take care of your own. Make sure that your own gets a Sabbath each week. See, 4th commandment, 8th commandment, and 10th commandment. All 3 of them deal directly with how to gain and keep wealth. God's law presupposes a strong, wealthy, dominant covenant people. Now, let's put this in perspective, because we like to sit here and think, oh yeah, 21st century Americans, everything revolves around us. Right? History has led up to this moment, and everything that comes after now will be epilogue. It's about me. And you too, because you happen to be near me. Right? The earth doesn't really revolve around, the sun doesn't really revolve around the earth. It's an optical illusion because I'm so close to the earth. The universe really revolves around me. Is that not the way 20th century Americans think? Sure it is. If we're going to understand the Bible in its context, we have to go back a few centuries. We have to understand that the people that God gave this commandment to 40 days earlier were slaves. Here's what they had. The clothes on their back and some shoes that weren't going to wear out for 40 years. And some stuff they had borrowed from the Egyptians. That's what they had. And God says, you make sure your manservant and your maidservant keeps the Sabbath too. They said, wow, we're going to have manservants and maidservants? This is good news. And he says, but don't you dare envy the one that lives next door to you. That one, that's off limits to you. See how he deals with a servant people, a slave mentality, is by starting off assuming that they are going to be given wealth if they keep his commandments. Now, not if they put $50 in the collection plate. And you've all heard that on television. You know what I'm talking about, right? Get that out of your thinking. Now, do you tithe? Well, that's an important part of what we're talking about. That's one of God's commandments. Which one? The 8th one. Will a man rob God? But you have robbed me. So yes, that is one of God's commandments. But it's not the only one. There are 9 others. There are 9 others, and we must keep all 10 of those commandments. Look, in Deuteronomy 8:18, let's do a little bit of a study. Is this gonna take a little while? Yeah. But I've already gotten into the part where we can't just cut it off and have it this afternoon yet. So I'm going to ask you, if your stomach begins to growl, just to let it growl, and we will get a chance to eat, I promise. Okay, in Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 18, thou shalt remember the Lord thy God. There's the commandment. Well, what is that? That encompasses all of them. Thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is He that giveth thee the power to get wealth. Now remember, these people are standing on the plains of Moab. They haven't been in the land yet. They've heard that it's a land flowing with milk and honey. But they haven't been there yet. For it is He that gives you the power to get wealth, and here's the purpose clause, that He may establish His covenant, which He sware to thy fathers. Now listen, the reason God is going to have you get wealth is not because He wants you to have jingle in your jeans. It's so that you can use that money to establish His covenant with you, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. That means don't you dare waste it. That belongs to your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren and your great-great-great-grandchildren. If evangelicals in this nation began storing up wealth for their future generations, how long would it take us just to take over a couple generations? You willing to waste that long? You're not going to do it any sooner. But here's what you have to do. You have to lay up for your children. Well, now, before you can lay up for your children, this isn't rocket science. In order for you to lay up for your children, you have to have it. Somebody said this week, you know, you've been talking an awful lot about money lately. That's okay. The Bible talks about money more than any other subject. I didn't know that. Well, it does. It tells you what money is. It tells you how to get money, and it tells you how to spend money. You know why? Because so much of your life is stored in money. In fact, if I may be so bold as to say, if I were going to define money, that's what it would be. It is the storage of wealth so that you don't have to spend everything as soon as you make it. One of the things that makes this country different from most other countries that I have visited is that we work longer than we have to. Most countries that do not have a Puritan work ethic, they work as long as they have to make a living, then they quit. And if they can't quit, they go out and hire some goons, some union bosses, to coerce their boss into making them work less. Say, 40 hours? Man, that's too much. God says 6 days. Shalt thou labor. Now granted, one of those days, or a good portion of each day, needs to be spent on the house, on the homestead. That's true enough. Having said that, you got to see these people's homesteads. They don't have much of a homestead either. God gives us money as a store of wealth. It's so that we don't have to eat everything we grow all at once. That's the nature of an animal. An animal eats until he can't eat anymore. A human being realizes, the sun's going to come up tomorrow, and I'm going to need some food tomorrow. And think about how, now, we live in a cursed world. We live in a fallen world. This world is not nearly as bountiful as it was when Adam walked on this earth. But even in a fallen world, we still make enough that we have everything that we need to eat for our families to eat, and we can do it in 6 days. So that's grace. And we don't recognize it. So, God gives us the power to make money. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Thou shalt remember the Lord thy God, for it is He that giveth thee the power to get wealth. And may I say, getting wealth is a fine translation here, but if I may interject just a little bit of biblical economics here, there is no such thing as finding wealth falling out of the woodwork. There's only one place in the world that's allowed to make money, and that's the U.S. Mint. Everyone else has to earn it. You earn wealth. You make wealth. You don't just get it by picking it up off the ground. When there was manna each day, then you could get wealth just by picking it up off the ground. Since then, we actually have to be of service to others. But if you are of service to others, here's what Jesus said. You want to be the greatest in the kingdom? That's fine. He didn't say quit being that. Here's what He said. If you want to be the greatest in the kingdom, here's how to do it. Serve the most people. Wait a minute, isn't that ambitious? Well, it's ambitious to serve. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, again, let me once again bring that caution back in here. And that is that if you're doing it for the money, that's not good enough. God has said you're trusting means if you do that. Rather, you set your heart to the covenant. You set your heart to glorify God in your work, to be of service to others in your work. And if you do it well, God says, I'm giving you the power to get wealth. So, in fact, in Genesis 13:2, where we're told that Abraham is translated into the Authorized Version, very rich. The word is, he was heavy. Glorious. He was glorious. Why? Because he was very rich. I think it's a good translation. Very rich is a good translation because it goes on to talk about all the stuff he had. He had big cattle and little cattle, and he had gold and he had silver. He had servants. And by the way, what did he do with those servants when he had them? When they weren't busy, he had them out marching to the tune of Psalm 144, learning how to war. When it came time for him to go get Lot, he didn't have to say, okay, we're going to start basic training tomorrow. The servants already had basic training. They already knew how to fight. They were already armed. So then all he had to do was let them go. It's time to fight. You know how. You've got the equipment. Let's go do it. Now, we don't want to read our perspective back into Exodus chapter 20. We want to consider that in Deuteronomy chapter 15, in fact, you know, Jesus said, well, the poor you'll have with you always. As though what Jesus was saying is make sure there's plenty of poor people around. Now, listen, that's not what Jesus is saying there. Jesus is saying the reason you have poor people is because you're not keeping my commandments. Is that? Wait a minute. Now, you're reading that back into the passage. No, I'm getting that from Deuteronomy chapter 15. Look with me at Deuteronomy chapter 15. And by the way, when that person said to me, you know, Pastor, maybe you're talking a little bit too much about money. Next thing I had to explain to them was, well, you know what? Show up Sunday. Because you haven't heard nothing yet. In Deuteronomy chapter 4 and chapter 15, verses 4 and 5, save when there shall be no poor among you. Well, when it's, he says, do this, make sure that your hand is compassionate toward another. Make sure that you're good to those that are around you, the poor people that are around you. But a time is coming, he says, only save when there shall be no poor among you, for the Lord shall greatly bless you. Again, these are former slaves, or slaves' children by this time, standing on the plains of Moab, about to enter into the land. He says, the Lord shall greatly bless you in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance to possess it. Only, I knew there was going to be a condition. Only if thou carefully hearken to the voice of the Lord thy God to observe all these commandments which I command thee this day. So now, if the question is, when will there be no poor among us? Then the answer is, when we begin to keep God's commandments. When the people of God keep God's commandments, here's the promise. There will be no poor among you. When is that going to happen? When you start keeping my commandments. That's Old Testament. So it is. Look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. Again, may I suggest to you that we don't have to have things repeated in the New Testament if the New Testament simply assumes that they're true. Right? If the New Testament comes at us and says, well, now, the poor you will have among you always, or if there's a quotation from the Old Testament, is it not right for us to look for a context and apply that context? All right, look at with that idea in mind, look at 1 Corinthians chapter 6. He says, how dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unjust and not before the saints? Now, look at this very carefully, because there are some people who say, this means we're not supposed to go to court. That's not what Paul said. What Paul said is, why do you go to court before the unjust and not before the saints? Now, what's he assuming? He's assuming you're going to run for office. He's assuming that some of you are going to be judges. And that you're going to know how to judge, not as the unjust judge, but as who? As the just judge. as the saints judge. Then look at this, verse 2. Do you not know that the saints shall judge? And another way of translating that same word is govern. Right? What do we understand the word judge to mean? Govern. Don't you understand that the saints are going to govern the world, are going to judge the world? Oh, well, that has to do with the future. That's in the millennium. Yeah, if it's not Old Testament, if it's not past, it's future. Nothing is for the nasty now and now, is it? Everything's for the sweet by and by, or for the, don't you know, that was the Jews. Beloved, listen to me carefully. Don't you know that the saints are going to judge the world? Don't you know that? And if the world, and he's going to argue now from the greater to the lesser, if the whole world can be judged by you, can't you judge these little peccadillo things among the church members? Don't you know how to do that? Look, if you're going to judge the whole world, well, wait a minute, I thought that was some future millennium saint that was going to be doing that. No, Paul assumes that I know how to do it. Well, how does he know I have the right standards? Because he assumes that my standard is the law of God. He assumes I'm going to have the same standard he does and that Moses had. Oh, well, wait a minute. Verse 3 says angels. That means in heaven. Well, now, wait just a minute. Stay with me for a minute. I'm going to show you how silly that is. Who exactly do you think you're going to judge in heaven? What angels exactly do you think you're going to judge? Are you going to judge the elect angels that can't fall? Or are you going to judge the angels that have already fallen and already been condemned? Well, how much expertise does that take? No, the word that's translated here, angels, is the standard word that we have for messenger. It means messenger every time it's used. Sometimes those messengers are spirit messengers. And sometimes those messengers are the teachers of the church, as in Revelation chapters 2 and 3. Now, what are we supposed to do when false teachers come to us? Are we supposed to say, I just can't tell the difference? We're supposed to judge. And how do we judge them? To the law and to the testimony. If they speak not according to this word, it's because there's just a little bit less light in them than there is in everybody else. No. Isaiah says it's because there is no light in them. So, can we judge the angels? Can we judge the messengers? Can we judge those men in the church who claim to be teachers, who come to us with doctrines? Yeah, we can. And how do we judge them? According to the law of God. And that's what Paul is saying. Look, if you can judge teachers, why can't you judge somebody who comes to you with a lawsuit? Why do you have to take that to the unjust? Why do you have to take that to the reprobate? Why do you have to go before unbelievers to have that judged when you can do it? I hope that disabuses you of a couple of ideas. At least a couple of ideas. Maybe a whole lot. That may have just given you a whole lot more insight into 1 Corinthians 6 than you thought you'd ever have. Paul is not saying, as long as you name the name of Christ, you can steal other people's stuff. And now, oh, I got a get out of jail free card. You can't take me to court. That's not what Paul is saying at all. What Paul is saying is because those unbelievers are subject to bribery, because those unbelievers don't have the right standards, don't go to court before them. Take your arbitration to court before the saints. Listen to what the saints have to say because they know the law of God. So, no, it's not just Old Testament. It's Bible. And it's not just for then, it's for now. It's not just for someday, it's for now. Beloved, I know we're taking a while, but I want you to understand something. This is an important doctrine, because if we're going to establish God's covenant, if we're going to establish peace, we're going to do it by means of God's law. Law and gospel. Law and gospel. And we can over law. But that's not the situation the church finds itself in today. The situation the church finds itself in today is over-lawing or over-gospeling. We need law and gospel. Now, I want so much to go on. May I? Okay, now, take off your shoes because I'm fixing to step on your toes. God has established the Sabbath so that we don't work ourselves to death. So much so that he has made this the very sign of his covenant. The sign of his covenant. Remember now, what's God's purpose in giving us wealth? Yeah, our purpose is so that we can enjoy the fruit of our labor. Under God, and in the context of God's commandments, by all means. But so that we can enjoy the fruit of our labor. God's purpose is not for you to enjoy the fruit of your labor. God's purpose is to establish his covenant. Now, in establishing his covenant, the sign of that covenant is the Sabbath. Now, if I yell at you, then you'll do it, right? No, I don't mean to be scoldy. I want you to understand the importance of it. I want you to see that this is not just something, oh, I guess so. If it means getting rich, I'll go ahead and take a day off. No, it's that we delight in the Sabbath. Isaiah 58 talks about people who delight not in their own ways, not in their own goings, not in their own doings, but they delight in the law of the Lord. They delight in keeping God's Sabbath. They take their foot off of trampling it underfoot. And here's what God says. To those that do that, I'll make them ride on the high places of Jacob. I'm going to put you on the mountain. I'm going to pull down the Idumeans and place you on the mountaintops. Not because it's magic, but because when we rest in the Lord one day in seven, the purpose for that rest is not idleness. It's for training and instruction in the ways of God. In other words, the church at that point becomes headquarters squadron for the army of God. We receive our marching orders from the Word of God. And we keep covenant faithfulness by stopping one day in seven, not just to recharge our batteries, it does do that, but also to be instructed in the ways of God. How should I live those other 6 days? What should I do? What does my business require? How does God's law and my business mix in such a way that I know how to live? So when I'm delivering packages, when I'm writing code, when I'm working as an engineer, when I'm working in whatever field of endeavor God has placed me, I know how to glorify God in it because I understand my occupation, I understand my work, and I also understand the law of God. So the Sabbath is not idleness. The result of covenant faithfulness is working and resting according to God's cycle. God has told us when to work. He's told us when to rest. And, you know, if we lived in ancient Israel, he told us what to eat and what to wear, when to wear it, what to plant in our garden and what to keep out of that garden, what not to plant next to each other. So that no matter where we looked, we saw the law of God in operation. Now, today, in this present day, here's what we have. We have one day in seven in which we are to be instructed in that very thing. How to find the law of God in operation in every part of our lives. So when we rest and work according to God's cycle, according to God's commandment, here's the result. Covenant blessing. Now, does that mean that everyone's going to be receiving the same amount of money, that we're just going to pool our resources and then divvy it up by the number of people that there are? No. That's only been lawful in one period in the church's history, and that's when Jerusalem was about to be destroyed. And people were saying, you know what? The city's about to be destroyed. The house isn't worth anything anyway. I might as well sell it. Apart from that, there is no period of history in which God expected the people of God to own things in common. In fact, Proverbs, write this down. If you don't get another note in your notes today, get this one. Proverbs 10:22. The blessing of the Lord, it maketh rich. Now, that's not a promise from me. It's not a promise that if you put $50 in the plate, you're going to have a check at home for $500. It's not a genie. It's not a magic spell. It's speaking about covenant faithfulness. And the sign of covenant faithfulness is the Sabbath. Here's what God is saying. If you can't take one day and seven off, what can you do? How are you saying that you're obeying me? How can you say you're following me if you won't even take time off when I tell you to? Now listen, today you can take your vacation whenever you want to. You want to take your vacation in July, you go right ahead. You want to take your vacation in January and go to Vail and go skiing, you go right ahead. There was a time, however, when God told you exactly when to take vacations. Three times a year, every male in Israel will go up to Jerusalem and have a party. It had a religious connotation, it had a religious content, but it was basically feasting. It was a vacation. It was time away from work. It was a time in which you did put your keys in your pocket and walk away from the homestead. Today, we don't have those three festivals a year. Actually, there were seven festivals, three of which were mandatory. But we do have, if you will, 7 weeks a year that God has required us to take off. 7 weeks a year? What 7 weeks are those? Well, it's actually measured out one day every seven. And God requires you to take those 7 weeks as vacation time. Not to spend in idleness, no, but to spend in instruction, to spend in learning God's ways. It's not a do-nothing day of idleness for the self-absorbed. It's not a day for football. It's not a family day. It's a day for you to be instructed in the ways of God. Now, with your family, by all means. But the key thing is the instruction. Look with me at Leviticus chapter 25. Okay, all Leviticus now, I know you're going back to the Old Testament. Verses 20 and 21. Now, this is something we don't have to do anymore. This is for ancient Israel. This is for the time before the cross. But I want to show you something. I want you to see what God is saying about His Sabbath year. In Leviticus chapter 25, verses 20 and 21. And if ye shall say, what are we going to eat in the seventh year? Because God required that every seventh year the land lay fallow. No crops to be grown in that seventh year. In fact, the reason that the captivity in Babylon lasted 70 years was because there had been 70 Sabbath years that they hadn't kept. And so God made the punishment fit the crime. More about that this afternoon. If ye shall say then, in that seventh year, well, what are we going to eat? You know, we're farmers. What are we going to eat in that seventh year? Here's what God says. Behold, then I will command my blessing upon you in the sixth year, and it shall bring forth fruit for 3 years. The year that is producing for, the Sabbath year, and the subsequent year while you're waiting for the harvest to come in. And see the grace in this. God doesn't say, if you keep my Sabbath after you've starved to death, then I'll give you increase. He says, I'll give you increase ahead of time. This is not simply about, well, we all know from studying at Rice University down here that if you let land lay fallow, it produces more. That's not what's going on here at all. God is saying specifically in the sixth year, before you've kept that seventh year holy, I will cause a bumper crop. And then you eat off of it for 3 years. Now, this means we have to be future-oriented, doesn't it? See, that's another thing that the Sabbath does, is it keeps us oriented toward the future, not toward the past, not toward what God did, what we have done. We need to know that. But we need to know that to be able to face the future. Look toward the future. Not only has God done mighty things for us, we expect Him to keep on doing mighty things for us in this generation and in the generations to come. So, the covenant rest does bring about revitalization, but it brings about revitalization after the blessing. First God blesses, then we get the bumper crop. Then we keep the Sabbath. And we see that even clearer today in these days in which the day of rest is what? Not after we've worked all week, but it's when? First day of the week. Get ready for the rest of the week. Listen for the rest of the week. So God blesses us in advance. And this is the confident rest of those who know I don't have to rush out every single day because God is faithful even on those days when I'm not working. God's still working. God is still causing the rain to fall on the Lord's day. He's still causing the sun to shine on the Lord's day. He's still causing people's hearts to desire the things that I'm willing to give them or sell them or do for them tomorrow. And then one last thing, and with this we'll close. And I know I've gone over. I in a sense, I apologize. I didn't mean to go this long over, but it's not like these things are useless to you. For the Edomite, for the covenant breaker, the exact opposite is true. You can't save enough. You can't put enough aside. You can't have enough money in your pockets to take care of tomorrow. Because the only thing God has promised the Edomite, the covenant breaker for tomorrow, is the certainty of destruction. So this does not rest upon our ability. It rests upon God's covenant faithfulness. It rests upon God's being willing to do for His people in a way, listen, that makes us the head of the nations and not the tail. That's blessing. And we don't have time to do it this morning, but that's what Deuteronomy 28 and 29 is all about. God blesses. He honors those that honor Him. And those who don't esteem Him, He despises. God does save His blessing primarily for those who walk with Him. Let's stand and call upon the Lord. Father, we have heard.